This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
At the end of 1999, the Malaysian media landscape experienced transformation. Malaysia Kini broke into the online platform, edging its way into the national conversation.
The online portal offered an alternative view to national politics, competing against its more traditional counterparts, namely print, radio, and TV.
Since then, the scene has blossomed, with a lineup of other news organizations joining the fray, such as the Malaysian Insider, and more recently, the Malay Mail Online. BFM 89.9, good morning, I'm Azif Azuddin.
And I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It. This week, we speak to the chief editors of Malaysia Kini, the Malaysian Insider, and the Malay Mail Online to explore the evolution of alternative media in Malaysia.
But before that, we have a couple of stories from Asia Calling. An Indian woman in Pakistan returned home after 13 years away. And Muslims in Europe unite to condemn the Paris attacks.
An Indian woman stranded in Pakistan for 13 years has finally returned home. Geeta was found wandering alone along one of the world's most heavily militarized borders. In distress over 10 years ago and was taken in by a shelter in Pakistan. Now, Geeta has made the long-awaited journey home. But there are still many mysteries to solve in her story. In this special cross-border report, Naim Sahotra and Jasvina Sagal trace her journey from Karachi to New Delhi.
The Bollywood movie Bajrangi Bhaijaan was a big hit in Pakistan this July. The story is about a young girl, Geeta, who mistakenly left India during her Kashmiri family's religious pilgrimage. Deaf and dumb, the young girl is unable to communicate to border police and find her way home. The movie took cinemas and cable networks here by storm.
Whenever it comes on cable, I watched number of times. But it doesn't get you bored. You don't get bored watching this film.
That's 46-year-old nurse Nasreen Patrick. She has been a fan of Bollywood movies since her childhood and says this story has something special. But when the movie was released, no one suspected it was based on a true story and that Geeta was living just kilometers away. A short walk from the movie cinema in Karachi, Geeta, the real character, is worshipping at a shelter home. Philanthropist Bilkis Idhi is the head of the shelter home and remembers the day that Geeta wandered into her care.
One day, she was found around the India-Pakistan border in Lahore. The India border security guards spotted her in distress and handed her over to their Pakistani counterparts, assuming that she was a Pakistani and mistakenly crossing into India.
Unable to hear or speak, and without identity papers, the border guards brought Geeta to the shelter, where she would spend the next 13 years of her life. Initially, she was registered as Fatima because it was assumed she was a Muslim. But things miraculously changed 5 years ago, explains Bilkis.
One day, some Indian program was being shown on the television in my room. Geeta was sitting here with me. That's when all of a sudden she started moving her hands excitedly, telling me that she belongs to India.
After that, she was given an Indian name, Geeta, and has been praying to be reunited with her family. When the Bajrangi Bhaijaan movie was released, Geeta's story became headline news. Following the hype, the Indian Deputy High Commissioner in Islamabad visited Geeta and accepted her as an Indian national. This month, she was issued visa. With unresolved issues between the two countries and a heavily militarized border, relations have been tense between India and Pakistan over recent years. In September, the two sides postponed much-awaited diplomatic talks to resolve long-standing issues, including discussions over Kashmir. But Geeta's story has become a symbolic of a stronger connection between the two nations. With a smile on her face, Geeta is packing up her belongings, getting ready to leave for New Delhi in the morning, where my colleague Jaswinder will continue to trace Geeta's journey.
Here at Indira Gandhi International Airport in New Delhi, thousands of people have come to receive Geeta. Among them is Janardhan Mahato, a man who claims to be Geeta's father. He has come with his three sons to receive his missing daughter and is sure she will recognize him instantly.
God is very great. Nobody can prove that she is not my daughter. Once she meets me, she will definitely hug me in her arms.
Janardhan claims that Geeta is her eldest daughter and that her real name is Heera. He explains how it was that she managed to go missing across an international border.
We married her to a boy of Kartapur in the state of Punjab. He took her to Maliha village, and after 2 or 3 months, the couple went to attend the fair of Baisakhi. But she got lost. 8 other relatives and I searched for her for 3 months. I put advertisement on television and in newspapers, but it was all in vain.
At the exit gate of the special lounge, people are eager to meet India's newfound daughter. And here she comes, smiling Geeta, dressed in a red tunic, her head covered with a matching scarf. She's clutching bouquets of roses. From the airport, she is taken directly to Indian Foreign Ministry for a press conference where she is welcomed by India's External Affairs Minister, Sushma Swaraj.
I thank the government of Pakistan from the bottom of my heart that without any delay, all the formalities of completing her papers were done in no time. Due to this only, today Geeta is here. I also want to thank the NGO who took care of Geeta in Pakistan all these years. Geeta is not an ordinary girl, and we will take utmost care of her.
But Sushma says that Geeta will not be handed over to Mahatos as she failed to recognize them. As the DNA results are being processed, Geeta will be sent to an institution in Indore, in Madhya Pradesh, where she will learn sign language. Monica Punjabi is a sign language teacher at the Indore Institute. She is also at the press conference telling Geeta in sign language what's going on. Geeta, who can understand some basic signing, replies to her using her hands, and Monica translates this into words.
She is saying that I want to live in India now. I am very happy here. I will definitely do some work, but we'll live here only.
From Bollywood to real life, the lead actor of the Bajrangi Bhaijaan film says India must make sure things turn out well for Geeta. In India and Pakistan this week, truth has proved stranger than fiction. For Asia Calling, this is Jaswinder Sehgal in New Delhi, India, and Naeem Sohotra in Karachi, Pakistan.
Wow, that was a twist. Geeta doesn't even recognize the people who claim to be her family members. I mean, I admire her resilience despite all odds. This reminds me a little of that 1997 Fox animated film. What was it called? Anastasia? Yeah, the Russian princess who found her way back to her grandmother after she was separated from her Romanov family through most of her childhood. Okay, now I feel like watching that film again.
We should. And it must have been a nightmare to be lost for 13 years with a new name and you can't communicate who you really are because she was mute, right? In the story. And I'm glad she's back in India, but at the same time, I'm horrified that she doesn't recognize the couple who claim to be her parents. This is like an M. Night Shyamalan movie, The Visit. Have you watched that, Azif?
No, I don't think so.
It's about some kids who spend the week with their grandparents whom they've never met. And, spoiler alert, they weren't really their grandparents. Identity is all you have sometimes, and to get that back is all a lost girl needs. As the international community continues to mourn the deadly Paris attacks that killed 130 people, Muslims in Europe claim they are facing a growing tide of discrimination. One group has decided to speak out in the wake of the attacks. The social media campaign called #NotInMyName has united Muslims from around the world in the public condemnation of terrorism. In South Yorkshire, Sheffield, our reporter Yasir Ali Khan has more.
According to government statistics, more than 100 cases of racially motivated attacks and abuse have been reported against Muslims in the week after the Paris attacks. Kabir Khan, 31, is an accountant. He has noticed that some people have treated him differently since the Paris attacks.
Since these attacks on Paris, my point of views in life has certainly changed, especially at work as well. I'm obviously getting a variety of different mixed race people giving me looks now. Obviously at work, when they talk about going on holidays, they're saying, oh, Muslims that, it makes me feel really uncomfortable.
Kabir says he even thinks twice about going out with his family now, whether it will be worth all of looks and comments they will get on the streets. For example, people have told him to go back where you come from. French citizen, 26-year-old Berengri Salami is studying communications here in the UK. Salami says people are quick to blame Muslims as though Muslims and terrorists are the same thing.
Because since what happened, people tend to put Muslims in boxes and they blame like all the Muslim community for the terrorists and for what happened. And I don't think it's fair because they have nothing to do with it and they're just innocent people who are as shocked as we are.
That's all the reason behind a new social media campaign that Muslims are using to speak out against terrorism. It's called Not In My Name and is the brainchild of Zara Kadir and her colleagues at the London-based charity, the Active Change Foundation. The attacks in Paris and ISIS, Zara says, don't represent Islam and people need to know.
And I know these people were not acting in the name of Islam. They were just using Islam as a face, as a mask to carry out these acts. I just felt like something had to be said and I couldn't sit back and not say anything. And we came up with the hashtag Not In My Name because it's one thing. It's not, you're not apologising for what's happened because you're completely saying that what is happening, what ISIS is doing and their groups like ISIS are doing is not in my name, which means it's not in the name of my faith.
The campaign has been endorsed by thousands of people from all over Europe who are posting pictures of themselves holding the message Not In My Name on Facebook, Twitter and YouTube. Critics have said Muslims should not have to distinguish themselves from extremist ideology, but Afshan, a 27-year-old law student, disagrees.
When I saw this trending, not in my name, I thought I had to take part because as a Muslim, I should have to take responsibility for the actions of the minority. They're not even following the right perception of Islam. Islam does not tolerate violence in any way possible. And it's not in our name. We didn't take any part of it.
And using social media, she says, is the fastest way to get the message across.
And I think if it can get trending on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, I think people will get the message a lot more faster. And then they'll start looking into it instead of just reading the newspaper and just believing what they see in the newspaper.
For the thousands of Muslims using the hashtag #NotInMyName, simple messages can create real change. For Asia Calling, this is Yasir Ali Khan in Sheffield, United Kingdom.
Yeah, ISIS, #NotInMyName. We should really spread this campaign to show solidarity. Over the weekend, Azif, I read an article about a former mufti condemning the Paris attacks. Guess where the mufti is from?
Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm, you got that right. Former number one extremist group now feels that ISIS has gone too far and has misunderstood Islam. I mean, I expected hate crimes to follow suit, but I hope campaigns like this can douse the flames of fear of Islam. I like this hashtag so much. I mean, I'm even contemplating starting back a Twitter account.
I'm not sure if that's the right choice just about now. But anyway, you know, this whole anti-ISIS thing reminds me a lot of the post-9/11 Islamophobia that wrecked America a decade ago. And it took a lot of people from different parts of the communities, both Muslim and non-Muslims, to reset that perception backstreet. And not all terrorists are Muslims. Yes, we know that. And that a small group of extremists are not representative of the whole community. But here's the thing, right? This is just another resurgence if you look back at what happened post 9/11. I mean, I must say though, last weekend there was a shooting at the Planned Parenthood centers throughout America done by extreme Christians. And you know what's infuriating? That the media's refraining from framing it as such, as a religious thing, calling them gunmen. Though, as we can see, double standards still and do exist. Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio 68H in Jakarta. And after the break, we explore how alternative media has evolved since it first came into the Malaysian media scene in 1999.
Here's what you can expect.
So for years, I've been telling people that a news portal is like a sandwich shop. You have to make a sandwich fresh and serve it to the people. You can't give anything that's stale to them or anything that's the same. So what we do is we try to do a lot of forward planning. Get the people who can break news, whether it's the scandals or issues of the day or decisions that can affect Malaysians at large. We have a whole bunch of reporters who are very good at getting the news that matters.
More of that in a minute. Stay with us. I'm Azif Azuddin.
And I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
This is, in case you missed it, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. This is, in case you missed it, I'm Azif Azuddin.
And I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
Malaysia Kini, Free Malaysia Today, The Malaysian Insider, The Malay Mail Online, The Rakyat Post, and The Ant Daily. If you've gone to any of these news outlets, chances are you've participated and engaged in alternative discussions.
Today, we will be speaking to Malaysia Kini, The Malaysian Insider and the Malay Mail Online to help us explore the evolution of the Malaysian alternative media scene.
Before 1999, the public largely consumed their information from traditional media, namely print, radio, and television. All the information spread through all these mediums generally subscribed to an accepted narrative.
At that time, the internet was uncharted territory. For Stephen Gunn, chief editor of Malaysia Kini, this provided the perfect platform to offer an alternative perspective to the news of the day, something you would never see reported on TV, print and radio.
We started in November 1999 and we went live on nomination day of 1999 election. Mahathir was still in power at that time. Anwar was serving his time in prison. We had three journalists, myself. When we launched, we have no clue how to publicize ourselves. We just basically let our friends know about Malaysia Kini. We send out emails to whoever happened to be part of our email group or whatever it is. We collect emails from everybody and let them know that, look, you know, there is a website called Malaysia Kini. And we started perhaps 1,000 readers. Later on, we see tremendous growth. 10,000 to 100,000 to the point where I think we reach about 300,000 readers a day. And that's really how we started. I think, you know, at that time, you have a lot of other websites, which we call reformatory websites. These are the harbingers to the blogs, because at that time, really, when we first started, there's no blogs, there's no Facebook, no Twitter, no Instagram. So I think it was a completely different world. You know, the broadband was unheard of at that time. Basically, the fact that the traditional media was not reporting about the main political events at that time in the way that the public had wanted, and that is basically the fact that at that time, massive demonstration on the street, of course, the deputy prime minister who was sacked and then being sent to prison. And I think, you know, people suddenly realized that tremendous change was happening and getting the kind of news that they should be getting. And they were looking elsewhere, and the internet was more or less the only outlet there for them to go for news.
Ever since then, the internet became home to alternative news. A buffet of blogs mushroomed, offering information that opposed the political sentiment of the day. For the Malaysian public who previously were fed on a loosely sanctioned state narrative, this was a breath of fresh air.
8 years later, in 2008, a group of ex-journalists and media executives sat down at lunch and talked about starting a newspaper. At that time, Jahabaz Sadiq, current CEO of The Malaysian Insider, well, he thought it was a dumb idea.
That's a stupid idea. We should just go online and they said, fine. This was late 2007. So then they said, let's try and get something together. And at the time I was in Reuters. So I said, okay, let's just figure out what we want to do. And we came up with a plan and one of them suggested the name. We got it registered. And by that time, that whole process took place. I already took a contract to work for Reuters Television in Indonesia. I was at the time Reuters Television in Kuala Lumpur. I took a three-year contract to work in Indonesia. So I said, well, I can't be part of this. You guys carry on. So my good friends, the first CEO, Sridhar Subramaniam, and the first editor, Feng Hong Kwan, took on the challenge. And they went online February 2008. I came in 2010. I did 2 years of my three-year contract in Jakarta. Mm-hmm. I came back to Malaysia. And my friends inside said, hey, why don't you come and take over as editor and CEO? Because we've done the initial bit, is what I did.
Fast forward 5 years later, in 2013, a group of journalists and editors from the Malaysian Insider broke off to form Malay Mail Online.
Many of us came from the Malaysian Insider, and we've offered an opportunity to basically bring a very old media brand into the 21st century, and we took up this challenge. You know, the Malay Mail name is a very old name. It's a very valuable brand. And I think we were just brought in to stick up this challenge of starting this website, if you like.
The Malay Mail Online carried with it a certain sense of history, its print counterpart being one of the oldest newspapers in the country.
Well, Malay Mail as a newspaper dates back more than 100 years to colonial days, and it's probably one of the oldest media brands in the country, if not the oldest, if you count the other being the Straits Times, which was basically a Singapore company. But as a Malaysian company or a Malayan company, Malay Mail is probably the oldest. And for us in MMO, we are just basically, since 2013, we have taken this media brand to the 21st century, if you like, using the internet as another platform. We still have a print edition. I'm only involved in the online edition, which is MMO. And we think that online allows us to reach a broader audience, to have a bigger say in the media space than compared to if we were just limited to a print copy. But having said that, what we've basically done as a media group is basically try to cover as many mediums as possible. Some people may prefer print, some people may prefer online, and we try to evolve as the market continues to evolve.
Starting an online portal isn't a walk in the park. While its operations and nature seems similar to a print newsroom, there are a different set of challenges that differentiates it from traditional media.
Two challenges that's going on in Malaysia. One is basically trying to get journalists to write with context and perspective for global audience.
That's Jahaba again.
A lot of people think the internet is Malaysian Insider, Malaysia Kini. Anyone else is just serving a Malaysian audience. And they're totally wrong because there's a total diaspora out there of Malaysians and people interested in Malaysia. So they might not understand some of the people we talk about or the nuances or history of the issues that are being put out on the portals, right? So you have to put things in context and perspective, backgrounders and all that. The second challenge in Malaysia is how do you make enough money to sustain what is essentially a service to the people of Malaysia?
As for the Malay Mail Online, their entry into the online media market comes at a time when the English language news market has already experienced saturation. For Leslie, tapping back into the Malay language is an opportunity in the midst of the language challenge.
Going forward, in terms of the media scene in Malaysia, it has to be said that the Malay language media is the most important place now. I think English language media is, in a way, very limited. The sphere of influence is limited to mainly urban elite. I think as media companies go to, in order to be of any influence, the Malay language is the place to be in, you know. I think there's a lot of potential. With the English language, if you are comfortable with the English language, you have the whole world to choose from when you choose content, when you go on the internet and when you switch on the TV. From America to Britain to anywhere in the world, to Singapore, you know, it's English. So competition is very heavy. I think there's still not enough Malay language content on the internet now.
For Malaysia Kini, however, financial difficulty was one of his main challenges.
I think our main problem when we first started Malaysia Kini is not so much making a political impact. I mean, that is given, really. It was easy for us to make a political impact because of the fact that there's no one else out there that's doing what we were doing at that time. I think the main problem for us was financial sustainability. And I think that was something that we were as much concerned about, in fact, even more concerned about. And eventually, when we faced a situation that we had to find other ways to actually raise money, we decided to go for a subscription model. And that worked to a certain extent to help us, to keep us going.
One thing we can all agree on is that generating revenue is one of the biggest issues across the board. The content on the Malaysian Insider is free. No paywall, no subscription. But for news portals that function this way, they usually need financial backers.
Okay, well, we're 100% free site in that sense. You don't have to pay an access fee. There's only one site in Malaysia where you have to pay an access fee, Skinny. So we rely 100% on advertisements. We are now owned by the Edge Media Group, so they sort of fund us as part of the lead in their digital expansion. Yeah, so we have managed to, over the last 7.5 years, creep up and reducing our burn rate. So we haven't broken even. We're close to breaking even.
Like the Malaysian Insider, the Malay Mail Online is also part of a larger media company. But even though they are an online counterpart, they too face money issues. And as with any online platform, their revenue comes from advertising.
Well, we're part of a media group and we sustain ourselves through advertising, of course. And it's tough, okay? I will be honest with you, it is very tough. And I think it's just as tough for everyone in the game. And primarily because Malaysia is a very small market. And there are a lot of players in this very small market. And when you're on the internet, you compete with the whole world. But going forward, I think I remain very, very positive. The only issue I will have in terms of advertising as a model, if you like, and I do believe it's the correct model, is that I think a lot of advertisers in this country have not caught up with the market. You look around you and everybody, nearly everybody I know anyway, goes on the internet to get information, to be entertained, to be informed, you know. I think very few people under the age of 30 even watch TV anymore directly, you know. Yet, a lot of advertising dollars are still going into the traditional media, if you like, disproportionately, if you ask me. That's why, as part of a group that includes traditional media, we feel that this is the best way going forward in terms of capitalizing on a changing market.
Both the public and the government have different reactions to these online portals. This is how Putrajaya has reacted to Malaysia Kini since 1999.
As expected, there is a lot of pressure from the authorities. We've been called traitors by Mahathir himself. We've been raided over the past 15, 16 years. We've been raided 3 times. The most recent was only a couple of weeks ago. The big one was in 2003 when 19 of our computers were taken away. And of course, we faced a lot of attacks from politicians, especially ministers and all that. So it was pretty hostile reception.
For the Malaysian Insider and Malay Mail Online, the reaction from the public has been quite similar. The public generally calls out on what they perceive as biased reporting, proven or otherwise. Whereas with politicians, it's a love-hate relationship.
In a day and age where online news portals are in abundance, how do these news portals remain relevant? The Malaysian Insider equates managing an online platform to a sandwich shop. Freshness is the key, regardless if you're into egg mayo or turkey ham.
You have to make a sandwich fresh and serve it to the people. You can't give anything that's stale to them or anything that's the same. So what we do is we try to do a lot of forward planning, get the people who can break news. Whether it's the scandals or issues of the day or decisions that can affect Malaysians at large, we have a whole bunch of reporters who are very good at getting the news that matters.
And here's Stephen Gunn's take on a similar vein.
I think continue reporting what Malaysians think, wanting newspapers, TV stations, radio stations, the mainstream, the traditional media to report. I think media will continue to remain relevant. It doesn't matter what medium it is, whether it's traditional or alternative, whatever, it doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, eventually it is important to have a vibrant democracy. You need to have a critical media, you need to have an independent media. And I think no matter what changes that Malaysia is going to have in the coming years, media will still be around.
Technology evolves, and with news, our consumption of it is limited to how extensively we interact with technology. This makes predicting the future difficult, as Stephen Gunn would put it.
It's hard for us to plan because, you know, that's the nature of the internet. Technology continues to evolve. There's no way they can plan ahead. We want to continue serving our readers. We want to continue to make sure that we're able to sustain ourselves financially so that we are able to retain our independence, because one of the major motto of Malaysia Kini is that independent needs independent financing. I think that's really, really important for us. So we want to make sure that stay that way. So really, we want to exploit whatever new technology that there will be in the coming years to make sure that we are one step ahead of everybody.
For the Malaysian Insider, expanding on current resources, exploring other platforms and stories is their game plan.
Well, we're just a portal. In the next few years, we'll probably expand more into video news where possible. And more storytelling, more stories about Malaysia. I think the direction is to veer away a bit from political news of he said, she said, they criticized, they slammed, and to explaining the issues of the day and the solutions and what civil society is doing with. I think the market today wants a lot more positive news, and they're not getting it from anyone. Online is the only way to go. Broadcast is still relevant. Electronic medium is the only way to go. Books are making a comeback, but newspapers, magazines, no, I doubt it. We are looking at a couple of books next year, restarting it. The issues with books we found was, one is distribution and at least breaking even on books. You know, there's a select number of books people will buy in Malaysia, but and they prefer fiction for some reason or other. You know, not hard-hitting stuff or issues of the day. Print is gone, it's dead.
Print is dead. Even for acclaimed news organizations such as the New York Times, Washington Post, and The Guardian, the traditional newspaper model has been scaling down, both in circulation and reception, especially in an age where information is consumed digitally.
For Leslie Lau, technology doesn't become an issue anymore. For him, it's the language market.
You know, there is this tendency in this country to look down on the Malay language, to look down on Bahasa Malaysia or Bahasa Melayu. It's seen as a working class language, if you like. It's not seen as an elite language. And it's not even seen as a language of Malaysians, regardless of your race. We wanted to make a Malay language website which was hip and current and appealed to all Malaysians. We were not focus on going after a market which is just Malay. You know, some people will say, oh, are you going to focus on entertainment stories? You know, that's pretty insulting, actually. You say, let's just focus on entertainment and sex, as if that's what the Malay language market is about. I think there's a lot of demand for information in Malay. In this country now, we've been having debates about whether English should be brought back as a medium of instruction in schools and so on and so forth. But I think the point is that the Malay language is strong enough to be a language of knowledge. But unfortunately, not enough media owners have decided that it's a hip language. And it's really up to us to make it a hip thing. So for Project MMO, the idea was it's secular, if you like. We don't subscribe to any agenda. We're just providing news. If anything, we wanted to put more international news there. Okay, we have a very small team now, so it's slow going now. We were trying to build from scratch. So we want to provide more international export. There's not enough international stories in Malay. There's not enough stories about the art scene internationally that's in Malay. I think we are doing a disservice to people who who use Malay as a primary language. You know, and it's a pity. This is the national language, and we're really doing a disservice.
That was Leslie Lau from the Malay Mail Online. And earlier you heard from Stephen Gunn of Malaysia Kini and Jahaba Sadiq from the Malaysian Insider. All are chief editors of their respective news organizations.
This week's show was produced by Cheryl Kaur, Hanif Baharuddin, Aisha Tajuddin, and myself, Azif Azuddin.
I hope this morning's show has been food for thought. And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
This is, in case you missed it, BFM 89.9,
the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.